I'm Karen Given, and this is Only a Game, except when it isn't.
To me, it's like not even close to just a game. Like, this is my family's culture. This is what we love and do and talk about and grew up bonding, playing together.
For John Cross and his family, the sport that's so much more than a game is soccer. It started with his older sister, Megan.
Wearing the number 9 as a jersey, and then my brother did the same thing, my sister Nikki did the same thing. And we kind of all just followed each other's footsteps.
John grew up in Pembroke, Massachusetts, a town of less than 20,000, about 30 miles south of Boston. The soccer-playing Cross siblings were written up in newspapers and magazines. The three oldest played Division I college. Nikki turned pro. John was the youngest.
It was a lot of pressure, I'm not going to lie.
Growing up, John always assumed he'd keep following in his siblings' footsteps. But his dreams would be derailed. And it's not like he didn't know any better.
I grew up with Just Say No. I got horror stories my whole life, and my generation grew up to be the worst heroin epidemic of all time.
That epidemic is important to John's story, because along the way, the NCAA, an organization usually not known for being flexible and forward-thinking, would be asked a pretty tough question. If drug addiction is a disease, as most doctors agree that it is, should a season missed due to drug addiction be counted the same way as a season missed due to a torn ACL? That might seem like a crazy question at first, but let me tell you the story from John's perspective. John's addiction has roots in junior high. He'd go into the woods to drink and smoke pot. He started taking Adderall. He says he wasn't much different from other kids in his area, kids who didn't become addicted to drugs. When do you feel like it started to become a bigger issue?
My junior year in high school. I was one of the better kids on my high school soccer team. And I couldn't stop smoking weed.
John was missing classes, so his coach told him he'd have to sit out for one practice. Instead, John quit. He never played high school soccer again. His parents were disappointed, especially his mom.
As much as you want to think that all these sporting games are for you, and they put so much effort into me. Like, she put so much time, like, going to practice, showing up to my games. For me just to, like, throw it away my junior year in high school was kind of slap in the face.
John moved to Florida for college, but he was still drinking and doing drugs. And without soccer to anchor his identity, he took on a new one, a tough guy from Boston.
I used to lie about being from Boston. I'm not from Boston. I'm from Pembroke.
John thought a change of scenery and a return to the sport he loved would turn things around. So he moved back to Massachusetts, enrolled in UMass Boston, and walked on to the soccer team. He knew that as an NCAA student-athlete, he'd be subjected to random drug testing, so
I went on this website called PassYourDrugTest.com.
John was looking for a way to keep doing drugs without failing a test. The website suggested opiates and cocaine, because those drugs leave your system relatively quickly. So that's what John did. But it wasn't a drug test that derailed John's first season at UMass. One day, after being out partying all night before a game, he just called the team captain and quit. Somehow, John convinced the coach to let him back on the team the next year.
At this point, though, my opiate abuse was really bad, so I showed up to practice every day high, and I knew they were drug testing people. They drug tested a friend of mine. I just felt like it was coming.
John says to save himself and his family the embarrassment of a failed drug test, he quit again, though he did manage to graduate, barely.
I guess I'll just be honest. My senior year, I paid people to write my papers. I'd say I'm an economics major, supply and demand. I have the money, they want to write papers. Boom, I must have learned something.
John's graduation, as illegitimate as it might have been, is important to this story because he hadn't used up all of his NCAA eligibility. But in Division III, eligibility ends at graduation. The NCAA does make exceptions, but it would be another few years before John was in any shape to challenge the system.
My drug use was already at a limit where if I had stopped taking them, I'd get sick. So I started working in finance in Boston, getting high every day in the parking lot. And that's where I started realizing that, like, I might have a little bit of a problem.
John tried another change of scenery. He moved to California, but
surprise, surprise, they had plenty of drugs in San Diego.
Before long, John was back in Massachusetts. He started taking regular trips down to New York City, where he says a crooked doctor gave him prescriptions for hundreds of Percocets at a time.
Then I would get on the bus. I'd bring them back to Massachusetts. And I remember I had moments where I'd look at the window and be like, is this your life now? Is this what you're doing? Are you just going to sell drugs? Like, are you ever going to kind of snap out of this? And then I'd say, of course I am. This is just a phase.
John started shooting heroin. Months passed. And then one day in May of 2014, a friend who'd been sober for years stopped by to check on him.
He sat down. He said, John, how's it going, man? I said, good. He said, really? I said, no.
The next day, John Cross checked into rehab. He was told he needed to reevaluate his entire life and how he looked at things.
Like, I thought I was going to be able to pet some horses and, you know, like do some yoga and maybe you'd feed me some organic greens and I would go home.
In truth, yoga and meditation played an important role in John's recovery. While he was in treatment, John called his friend, the one who had gotten sober years earlier.
I said, do you think everybody at home knows I'm a drug addict? Because I'm really nervous about everybody finding out. He says, yeah, man, the funny thing about that is you're usually the last one to find out.
After rehab, John moved to Portland, Maine. That's when he realized he missed soccer. He missed everything about it. He thought maybe he could coach or consult with a team.
And I emailed a bunch of local coaches. I said, hey, this is my story. I don't want any money. I don't want anything else. I just want to be a part of the game.
He got one response from the head coach at the University of Southern Maine. But John hadn't as much as touched a soccer ball in 2 or 3 years. So before he showed up for the interview,
I went out to a park and I went up to a bunch of people. I was the only kid that spoke English. I said, can I play? They said, what? And I just raised my hand. They passed me the ball and then I started going down there every single day.
John was invited to help out with the team at Southern Maine. He was 26 years old and 40 pounds overweight. But the coach knew how much John loved to play. So whenever the team scrimmaged, John was allowed to join in.
And I remember one of the kids told me later on, he goes, I thought when you first put on your cleats, like, this guy's going to be terrible. Look at the size of him. And he's like, then you started playing and you were good. He's like, you got out of breath quick, but you were good.
Players on the team started teasing John, telling him that he should join the team for real. But by then, he'd read the NCAA regulations. They're available online in PDF files.
And I would look at the PDF and I'm like, my eyes would get all squinty and I would just stare at him and be like, okay, it's saying you can't do this.
John kept staring at those PDF files, looking for some kind of loophole. He found one that would require him to attend graduate school at the same university where he finished undergrad. But that wasn't going to work. John had graduated UMass Boston with a 1.98 GPA.
I wouldn't be able to get into graduate school anyways.
So he approached the compliance officer at Southern Maine, where he was helping with the team, to see if that school would petition the NCAA for a medical exemption, just like schools often do for a player who suffered a season-ending injury.
And he's like, well, that's not a thing. That's not a real rule. And I was like, well, we should make it one.
John Cross and Southern Maine filed the paperwork. John received a letter saying the request was denied. So did the compliance officer, but
he goes, yeah, well, we got a phone call. He goes, they said no, but they'd like for you to appeal it because they think your story's kind of interesting.
John gathered letters from doctors, and he wrote his own letter explaining how much it would mean to him to finish a college soccer season. He wanted to walk on the field on senior day, take a picture with his parents, and present his mom with flowers.
I don't know why I was so attached to that day, but I was. I was just like, I really think that it would mean something to my family and myself.
But while he was waiting for an answer from the NCAA, John's mother was diagnosed with late-stage lung and brain cancer. John traveled back and forth between Maine and Massachusetts to help care for her, and he kept working on his soccer skills.
And also running, like a drug addict Rocky, right? Like by myself. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm even playing. What am I doing? Why am I dribbling this ball around?
Finally, John called the NCAA directly, which is definitely not encouraged in those PDF files.
I said, listen, am I playing or what? She's like, who is this? I'm like, this is John Cross. She's like, oh. And she got all weird and like quiet. She's like, we just got out of a meeting for you. You must have caught them on a good day. You'll be the first person to get eligibility for this. Congratulations, you're playing next year. I remember I took the phone away from my ear and I was like, I am?
We've asked the NCAA to confirm that John Cross was the first person to be granted a medical eligibility waiver due to past drug abuse. They haven't responded. But the eligibility office at Southern Maine has confirmed everything else. All season long, John's mom, Noelle, was too sick to attend his games until senior day.
And I remember I got up that day. It was freezing cold. My dad's like, "Your mom's coming. Like, she's coming. She has to be at the game," she said. I said, "Okay."
John Cross walked onto the soccer field at the University of Southern Maine, carrying flowers for his mom. The PA announcer introduced him.
And they listed, like, the three schools that I'd been to, and I was like, wish they skipped over that. And they're like, "John's, you know, is a leader," and they were saying all these things, and I was like, am I? Like, I can't believe I'm here. Because I thought I was going to either be dead or in jail, or never thought I was going to be doing this that day. I gave flowers to my mom, my dad. We took a nice little picture. They got their day, and I'm just glad that I could be a participant in their day, as weird as that sounds.
And then what happened with your mom?
So I went home. I sat down on my couch. My phone rang. It was my dad. He says, "There's complications with your mom's cancer."
Brain cancer is a strange thing. Sometimes it moves slowly, sometimes quickly. In the hours since she'd left the game, Noelle Cross had lost the ability to walk and speak.
So the last time I ever saw my mom walk on her own was off that field, speaking fluently like I remember.
John Cross left his soccer team again, but this time they knew exactly where he was, back home, spending time with his mom. And a few weeks later, when the team played an away game not too far from John's hometown, his teammates insisted that he take the field. He'd finally finished a full season of college soccer.
Like, we didn't win a lot. I didn't play spectacular. I was like, you just accomplished something that you can be proud of. You are a good teammate this year. You were a good son.
Noelle Cross died a month later, on November 25th, 2015. These days, John Cross speaks to athletes about his addiction and how he keeps himself balanced in sobriety. And he's an assistant coach at St. Joe's College in Maine, where the players know his story, and he leads them in yoga and meditation once a week. We'll have a link to John's website at onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
This podcast is made possible by Samuel Adams. For 34 years, Samuel Adams has made their Boston Lager inefficiently. Sam Adams brews with 100% heirloom Mittelfrüh hops, lagering their beer for over a month. The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor the flavor responsibly.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Sure, you listen to this podcast and all the other NPR podcasts because of how much stuff we know. But what about you? When do you get credit for how smart you are? Well, the time has come. The Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me quiz game is now available via your smart speaker. Just ask it to play Wait, Wait. And finally, recognition and prizes can be yours.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know.
I don't know. Maybe I'll see you again. I'll do everything possible.
That was Andy Murray speaking at the Australian Open after what might have been the final tennis match of his career. And that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Lindsay Gibbs of Think Progress and by Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Lindsay, you're up first.
Australian Open, usually a very joyous slam, but it started out a little sad with Andy Murray announcing through tears that the hip problem that kept him out of the tennis most of last year is probably going to end his career. Andy Murray, of course, was a part of the Big Four with Novak Djokovic and Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer. He only won three slam titles and only spent a few weeks at number one, so did not have the dozens of slams that they have amassed. But he competed with them on a week-in, week-out basis, and I think gave a little bit of hope to all of us who aren't these perfect human specimens of tennis greatness, that we too, if we had enough heart, could compete and be among the best. Of course, what I will miss him the most for is for his advocacy for women. He famously hired Amelie Mauresmo to be his coach, and he got a lot of backlash for that. And he said that really opened his eyes to what women in sports have to deal with.
Mike, what do you think?
I never really got Andy Murray's big four. Okay, that's like the big four of the British invasion, Rolling Stones, Beatles, The Who, and then, I don't know, the Animals, the Bee Gees. Someone's got to be the fourth. Or let's not be so deprecating. He's Teddy Roosevelt on the Mount Rushmore. And I love Teddy Roosevelt. But this article that, Lindsay, that you pointed me to explains some of it, which is just how different he is personality-wise. You know, he was the guy who most clearly saw himself in relation to the world of tennis and would probably be the first to say, okay, big four, but I was fourth.
Yeah, that article is by Brian Phillips of The Ringer, and if you haven't seen it, you should look for it. But, Mike, I'm kind of with you. I hate to admit this, but I always found myself forgetting about Andy Murray. And then something would happen, and I'd be like, oh, yeah, Andy Murray. Like, he would win Wimbledon and put a lot of British angst to bed, and I would be like, oh, yeah, Andy Murray. And he hired Amelie Mauresmo, and I was like, oh, yeah, Andy Murray, you know? And now that it all might be over, I feel really bad about those oh, yeahs.
You know, that's Andy Murray. I think he would love this assessment of him from both of you, which is kind of what makes him so special, right? My favorite clip, I'll finish on this. There was this little interview show going around asking all the players at Wimbledon, how do you eat your strawberries? And people were saying, you know, with cream or sugar. And Andy Murray goes, with my fingers.
All right. Well, this week, ESPN's Outside the Lines published its investigation into, quote, the biggest threat to the sport of football. And that threat is insurance. The NFL only has one option when buying workers' comp and liability insurance. And that whole thing trickles down from the college level all the way to Pop Warner. Football leagues are finding it more and more difficult to get insurance. And if there's no insurance, there's no football. This is, of course, due to head injuries. Insurance companies are worried about having to pay out billions of dollars in claims over the next 20, 30, 40 years. Though it kind of reminds me a bit of Al Capone being taken down for tax fraud.
Right.
Lindsay, is insurance what spells the end of football?
It could be. You know, I've written so many articles about concussions, and I haven't thought about the insurance angle to this. So this, to me, was like, you've been focused on the wrong monster the whole time. Like, it's actually, like, the younger sister or something. Like, you know, you can't have kids playing the sport if there's no insurance. And it seems like it's already hanging on by a thread. This isn't, like, forewarning as much as it is there's a crisis right now.
Yeah, the Outside the Lines piece quoted an expert who said, I don't see there being a football in 10 years. I've read and immersed myself in a lot of these predictions. I think they're very overblown because even though football is getting a little less popular, it's still by far the number one most popular sport in terms of high school participation. Every time you ever read a pre-obituary about the death of football, there's always the graph of, and look how popular lacrosse is coming. Look how popular soccer is becoming. And very notably, though tucked inside this article, this is an article about the impossibility of insuring all contact sports, not just football. I think that's really notable.
Mike, I picked up on exactly the same thing that you did. Hidden in this article was the information that insurance carriers aren't just refusing to cover football. They're talking about not covering hockey and soccer as well. And I really don't think we're going to become a country that just plays basketball. So I think probably what we're looking at is some other kind of solution here. And for me, the best case scenario is that we switch to, at the youth level anyway, flag football, no check hockey, and no header soccer.
Although if we had no check hockey, Jaromir Jagr's career would be cut short, wouldn't it?
Well, he's an adult. He can do what he wants. But,
okay,
you know, I'm
talking
kids. All right, Mike, you're our closer this week. What have you got?
I've always been fascinated by Todd Marinovich, the robo QB who was raised to eat, breathe, and spit out football, and spit it out he did under the, you could say tutelage, or you could say oppressive thumb of his father, the trainer and former athlete, Marv Marinovich, was crafted to be a perfect quarterback. The big story that you would always hear about Todd Marinovich was that he, quote, never ate McDonald's, and this was shocking. And I always think of that these days because most of the kids who my kids know in Park Slope, Brooklyn have never eaten McDonald's. The more you find out about the Marinovich story, it wasn't just the story of a crazy father, though it was that too. It's a real story of abuse. And Sports Illustrated had a very lengthy profile of where the whole family is. And the answer is Marv essentially dying from the effects of Alzheimer's. His daughter, who was just always ignored, doing most of the caretaking. And then you have poor Todd, who, for everything else, is the robo-QB, is in many ways just a variation of the story of addiction. It's this sad story that has been with me as a consumer and a creator of sports media since I've been paying attention. Now that it's in its final chapter, we're, I think, learning to think about it a little bit more accurately in a more nuanced way.
I wasn't as familiar with the story until I read the piece, and what is so often overlooked when it comes to addiction, when it comes to these high-level, single-minded achievers, is the people in the family who are left out of that mix or who are left behind to do the caretaking. And that's what the sister really represented in the story, you know, being ignored by her family for all these years and then coming in at the end of the day and picking up all the pieces. What a heart-wrenching story kind of all around.
I wonder if we've actually learned anything. I mean, I had a parent tell me about when his babies were small, he would move their legs really, really fast, hoping that they'd grow up to be really, really fast. And I laughed and he laughed. And then it wasn't until I read this article that I remembered, yeah, that was a classic Marv move, right?
Yeah.
Like that was something he did. Have we learned anything at all since the days of Marv and Todd?
I think it's very hard to, because as the story moves, the target and the concern moves. So it used to be one of over-involved parenting. Now it seems one of abuse. And I think that most people also say, well, I'm not that extreme.
Right.
But in many ways, you know, there are elements of that extremeness that a lot of parents have with their children.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Lindsay Gibbs of Think Progress and Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
A few years ago, radio producer Otis Gray took to the stage at a Moth Story Slam to tell his story of settling a score, or trying to, on the lacrosse field. Here's Otis.
You know that kid in high school? The jock. Great at sports, good looking, he gets the girl. Well, I wasn't that kid. But I knew that kid. And his name was Andrew Boyle.
Everyone just called him Boyle because he had the personality of a festering wound.
I was an art kid in high school, and I had flaming red hair, which made me an easy target for Boyle and the other high school elite. They called me Ginger, Carrot Top, Daywalker. But I played sports. I played soccer, cross-country skiing, yes, a thing in Vermont, and I played lacrosse.
Boyle stuck to football, hockey, and also lacrosse. So we played midfield together, except he was on first string because he was good, and I was on third string because I knew what tertiary colors were.
Besides being a jock, besides acting like an alpha gorilla in heat, what made Boyle even more annoying was that he was really, really smart. Like, you'd call him out for being a jerk, and he'd humiliate you with logic, and he'd point, and he'd laugh.
He had this awful laugh. It was like a dolphin, like, ha.
Boyle and I were nemeses. Now, here's where things get interesting. Boyle and I had some weird mutual respect for each other, because I knew that under the sludge coating around his heart, he was actually a good kid. And even though he called me Vincent Van Gogh, which, if you think about it, that's a compliment, I think he respected my artistic abilities.
And our grandparents lived close together, so sometimes we would actually hang out, and we wouldn't tell anybody, because we were nemeses, and we had an image to uphold.
In school, I could deal with his insults. I just let him run out of steam, and I could go about my day. But there was one insult. There was one word that got under my skin every time, and he knew it.
He would wait till there's a bunch of people around, and he would yell as loud as he could,
Fire Bush.
This made me livid. And one day, when I was at my wit's end, he yelled Firebush across the entire cafeteria and something snapped. And I decided, Boyle's gonna die. Every month or so, our lacrosse coach ran a drill called Settle Your Beefs. Basically, if you had an issue with someone, this was your chance to call them out, and they had to go one-on-one with you to the goal.
And I usually do not participate in this because I was not good. But today was special, because I had just gotten a brand new stick, and I was contemplating murder. So I step up,
and I call out Andrew Boyle. The team goes berserk. Boyle just looks at me and he smiles.
And I know exactly what he's gonna do. He does this one stupid dodge every time. He runs up, he like spins and throws his arm over your head. It's horrible, and I know he's going to do this, and I'm going to decimate him. So I am down and I'm ready, and he starts his run and he's coming at me faster and faster. And he does not stop. He plows straight into my body, and I feel this crunch in my chest as I'm sent through the air like a weightless ginger rag doll. And I'm on the ground, gasping for breath, looking up at the sky, and I hear the dolphin laugh. And Boyle steps over my dead body and places the ball into the goal.
The team was in tears, laughing. Even the coach could hardly stand up. And I looked over at my new stick, which he had hit so hard that it bent in a V shape across my chest.
Next time, Boyle. Next time.
That's Otis!
That's kind of where the story ends. There was no next time. When I got off the stage, people immediately came up and asked me, where's Boyle now? What's he doing? And at the time, I didn't really know or care. 2 long years passed. I decided to dig up this story and pitch it to this show. They essentially rejected it. And they had the same questions that many others did. Where is Boyle? Well, funny story.
Before we start recording, you got to tell me what we're doing.
Why?
Because you got to tell me where this is going, who's going to listen to it.
Like legally?
What the rules are.
Unlike most humiliating high school memories, this one had emerged from the deep annals of history where it belonged and was now sitting in my family home in Vermont with his German Shepherd, Diesel, 10 years later, pouring me a glass of rye whiskey.
I'm Andrew Boyle. I work for the power company in Vermont, and I coach hockey.
I first told this story at a competition in Philadelphia, and it won. A video of me telling the story went online, and then it got published in Philly Weekly. People all over Philly would write me on Facebook or email saying things like, LOL, Boyle eats boogers, or haha, Boyle is a loser waffle. You rule, Otis. I felt a little bad. And I'd like to think that I decided to post this video on Facebook and tag him in it for ethical reasons, to let him know that I used his name. But if I'm being honest, I felt that I may have finally defeated Boyle, and I could not wait to tell him about it. Instead,
pumped up, loved it.
He shared it with everyone he knew.
Oh, everyone. Yeah. Of course, somebody told a story about me on a big stage and won some money. Of course I'm going to share it with everyone. And then I think my parents shared it with all my grandparents and cousins. And then it was shared instantly by my entire fraternity in our group. I remember dating someone and they showed their family and their parents. Everyone.
We ran into each other at a bar around the holidays about a year back. He bought me the most expensive whiskey in the bar and he thanked me for telling the story. Told me he showed his little siblings too and said if they acted like him, people would tell stories about them someday.
Do you vividly remember that day?
Yeah.
Really?
Do you?
I don't remember you calling me out. I don't remember breaking your stick. I remember always joking with you, calling you Firebush, but that's about it.
These last couple years, I thought telling this story gave me the upper hand with Boyle. But it's hard to feel like you're winning a feud that one side doesn't even remember they're in.
Did you want me to be upset about it?
I didn't have any intention at all. I just didn't think that you would love it and share it with everyone you know.
Oh, knowing my personality, you didn't think I would love it?
It didn't surprise me, but I was like, he won again.
But I was like happy. I loved it, and I was happy for you because like it was like, yeah, Otis is killing it. Like he's doing well, and like he's making me famous. Like this is awesome. Like, I always knew you were going to be successful because, like, you're just crazy creative. And also just, like, someone I didn't understand because you didn't care about competition. You were just someone that fascinated me because I had no understanding of how your brain worked.
How would you describe yourself in high school?
I don't know. I definitely didn't. Like, I told you how I thought of you. Like, I would not sugarcoat anything. And I did not care how you felt about it if I told you.
Do you think you could mess with me more than other people?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Why?
Because you're just like you were always good. Like whatever was going on, like it was just Otis. Like
somehow, sitting in front of Boyle right now, I feel like the jerk for making him infamous as a bully, a tormentor, a jock.
Would you ever care that people thought you were just kind of a jerky jock?
No, that's fine.
Why don't you care?
I don't know, man. Like, if you go through your whole life, like, living your life based on what people think of you, that's not, like, gonna be a productive or happy life.
High school's good for people like you, I think. You were good at sports. You were good-looking. You were smart. Teachers liked you a lot. Like, you had a pretty good run of it.
Maybe. But I wouldn't say I was, like, I was good at those things because I work extremely hard at them. So it wasn't just, like, I was just good at them. Before practice, I'd be waking up at 4:45 and going to workouts 3 days a week. It wasn't like I was just good at it. I was just, like, there was a reason I was good. It's because I worked. Looking back now, I think when hearing you call me out, for me was shocking. It was shocking because like why is my friend calling me out? Like why would Otis call me out? What is he mad about? Like we joke around in the cafeteria, sure, but like why would he be upset at me? So, but then probably feeding off everyone's reaction and being like, "Well, if you're going to call me out, Otis, like okay. But I'm going to show you why I'm the one waking up at 4:30 every morning and working my ass off."
We ended the interview. Boyle got in his truck with his dog, Diesel, and he backed out of my snowy driveway into the night. And as the taillights disappeared into the darkness, I couldn't help being a little bit jealous of Andrew Boyle. Here's a guy who knows who he is. He has a code he lives by. He always has. He's sincerely confused about the notion of caring what people think, and I can't say the same for myself. I remember when my good friend's dad passed away in high school. My friend, she has celiac. She can't eat gluten. Boyle barely knew her, but went over to her house the morning after to cook her gluten-free mac and cheese, a memory that she still holds really close to this day. I asked him about this, and he doesn't even remember it. But he says it sounds like something he'd do for someone on the worst day of their life. Boyle's personality sometimes made him a real loser waffle. And I know that hearing all this will only make him more cocky. But it's also nice to know that someone that unabashedly sure of themselves has always believed in me, without a doubt. I don't know. What I do know is this time, he won again. And he's annoyingly undefeatable. Next time, Boyle, I'll bring the whiskey.
Otis. Otis Gray is a radio producer and storyteller living in Vermont. His story was originally told at a Moth Story Slam, music courtesy of Blue Dot Sessions. Kevin Motzinger is a high school football coach in North Carolina, but after Hurricane Florence tore through his community, he became much more than that.
I'm not a whiner. I'm not one to sit there and mope and pout. You roll your sleeves up and you go to work.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Karen Gibbon. Next week on Only a Game, we'll have the story of Brenda Tracy, a rape survivor who's visiting locker rooms across the country to try to put an end to sexual assault. But now, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
I'm obsessed with the Kyrie Irving / LeBron James phone call that apparently took place on Wednesday night. But I think we should start with a recap. Why were these two guys feuding in the first place?
Well, because Cleveland wasn't big enough for both of them, basically. And Kyrie believed that LeBron leaked the news that Kyrie wanted to be traded and blah, blah, blah. And now, though, we have a Hallmark TV movie because Kyrie, in his anxiety to be the leader of the Celtics, called LeBron and apologized and asked for tips, apparently.
Right. The phone call apparently happened after Kyrie shockingly discovered that being a leader isn't as easy as it seems like it would be.
Or as much fun, apparently.
Well, depending on who you ask, this was either, quote, the next step in Kyrie Irving's evolution as a player and a leader, or it was just a ploy to get more money in his next contract. What do you think?
I think you can multitask. I think it's possible to do both. It seems to me to be a logical thing to do. And if you're going to ask somebody for help on how to be the alpha dog on your team, who better than the most alpha of alpha dogs?
NBA refs will answer questions from fans via Twitter during actual games starting on Monday. What could possibly go wrong?
Oh, Lord above. Well, if you just filter out the variations of, are you freaking blind? You're going to be down to a manageable number of questions, I think. This is asking for trouble, of course, and I don't expect this experiment to last very long.
Well, it doesn't
Besides,
start.
NBA refs can interact with the fans anytime they want. I've been to games. I've seen it happen.
This whole thing doesn't start till Monday, but the refs have already gotten one really interesting question, don't you think?
Yes, from LeBron James. What really is, quote, in the shooting motion? Asking for a friend.
I don't think they've responded
Now, why
yet.
Would anybody wonder why Kyrie Irving would ask a guy like that a question?
Maori Davenport plays high school basketball in Troy, Alabama, and due to a clerical error by USA Basketball, she received a stipend check for playing in an international tournament. She returned the money, but she's still been ruled ineligible for her entire senior season. Really? How is this even a thing?
Because you cannot get the tiny little tin pot Caesars of amateur basketball to do anything sensible. It is obvious that this woman should be allowed to play. It is ridiculous, and it's become a national embarrassment for the Alabama High School Athletic Association.
Well, a judge will consider the situation on Tuesday, and I'm really hoping that he's a more reasonable individual than whoever's calling the shots at the Alabama High School Athletic
It's astonishing to me that they haven't backed down on this yet. It is very simple. You reinstate her, and you say, we were wrong.
Okay, Charlie, I know you probably have a lot to say about this next topic, so I'm just going to step back and let you describe the feast the national championship team from Clemson was treated to at the White House this week.
Well, the interesting thing to me is that Clemson hires and pays a fairly substantial salary to a nutritional consultant to keep the players away from exactly the food they were served in the White House.
Cheat day, man. Cheat day.
The picture of Donald Trump with this enormous front yard of burgers in front of him. I mean, you know, the picture of Eisenhower before D-Day and Kennedy at the Berlin Wall. We're going to have Donald Trump in front of this endless spread of burgers. But I do have to give the Clemson Tigers credit. They behaved like guests, and now everybody's trying to feed them.
Well, absolutely. Clemson can probably eat for free for the next year with the number of restaurants and celebrities that have offered a more fitting celebration.
There's a Michelin 3-star in Chicago that invited them. Michael Strahan wants to give them lobsters and caviar. I predict right now that Clemson will not repeat as national champions because they're all going to weigh 670 pounds by the end of the offseason.
And finally, Charlie, I'd like to take you to the LA Kings game last Saturday night into the broadcast booth for a very special appearance.
Hands up. Oh, watch out. Oh, he stole on him. He fired on Cuz. Hold on now. Oh, get it cracking then. Let's go. Snoop Dogg in the house. Let me see some.
That was, of course, Snoop Dogg. And while I don't share his love of cracking, he's not at all bad as an analyst, is
no,
he?
No, apparently he's a real fan, and God bless him for being a hockey fan. Showed up with the Stanley Cup rings, which were very impressive. Managed to work with two of the whitest people he'll ever work for.
And he did work with Martha Stewart.
Well, that's true, too. Yes, okay. Two at a time. But it was fabulous. I want the Doc Emmerich Snoop Dogg broadcast team just for one game.
I want to hear one more. I mean, his understanding of the game is absolutely unmatched. Listen to this.
47 seconds left in the first quarter. Yeah, first period, so they say in hockey.
I'm with him there.
Yeah, what are you supposed to say? First third?
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins us each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Do you know what time of year it is? Here, maybe this will help.
Super Bowl haiku. Whose stupid idea was that? What clown thought that up?
In case you were wondering, yes, that was Bill Littlefield, and yes, it's almost time for Super Bowl haiku. Submit your tiny poems of 17 syllables at our website, onlyagame.org, or by emailing us at oag@wbur.org, or on Facebook or Twitter at onlyagamenpr. This past football season, the Wallace Rose Hill High School Bulldogs competed for their fifth straight state championship title. The Bulldogs play in Teachy, North Carolina. It's not one of those affluent communities where parents can afford to hire private coaches and send their kids to expensive sports camps.
Our school is just hardworking, poor country folks.
But early in the season, the Bulldogs faced a challenge they never could have imagined. Andrea Aswahe has the story.
In early September, Kevin Motzinger, head football coach and weightlifting instructor at Wallace Rose Hill, led his students in prayer.
I broke down and cried in all four classes, and I ain't never been much of a crier, but I really felt like there was kids in that class that I'd never see again.
Hurricane Florence was on the horizon.
North Carolina is now under a state of emergency ahead of Florence.
As many as a million people have evacuated inland to higher ground.
The National Weather Service describes it as, quote, the storm of a lifetime.
The 45-year-old football coach had stayed home during several hurricanes, but when the news arrived that Florence was upgraded to a Category 5.
We locked everything up and we hopped in the truck and we took off.
The coach, his wife, and their two sons evacuated nearly 400 miles inland, close to Tennessee. Meanwhile, 18-year-old Cameron Donaldson and his family were preparing for an upcoming move. They loaded almost all of their belongings into a storage facility before evacuating.
We was packing things for like a week. We didn't think the storm was going to be as big.
Cameron, who goes by KD, his mother and his six brothers and sisters crammed into close quarters at a relative's house about half an hour from Teachy.
I was scared the storm. It was scary. I used to play outside in hurricanes, not this one.
Before making landfall, the storm was downgraded to a Category 1. Still.
The U.S. Eastern Seaboard is now feeling the wrath of Hurricane Florence.
The real danger of this storm isn't the wind, it's the duration, it's the rain, and then the storm surge.
Catastrophic freshwater flooding is expected over portions of the Carolinas.
Florence dumped nearly 3 feet of rain throughout the state, but parts of Duplin County, home to Wallace Rose Hill High School, were left under more than 25 feet of water.
You know, it's like I always joke and say, you know, son always wants to run to mama. Well, all the water's got to go to the ocean. and ours has to head east. Then we got all that was coming from everybody else.
8 people in Duplin County died in the aftermath of the storm. Coach Motzinger and his family, like many in North Carolina, were displaced. They finally settled into a rental property in Wilmington, 2 hours away from the high school. 3 weeks after evacuating, Coach Motzinger returned to his home.
When I pulled on our dirt road, all the dead fish, dead deer, and just all the stuff that's floated from everywhere, when it looked like a war had taken place in our neighborhood, and we lost.
Coach Motzinger's home had extensive water damage. For Katie and his family, the situation was even worse. The storage unit holding the family's belongings was under 5 feet of water. Everything was ruined.
When my mom saw that, she immediately broke down and started crying. I said, it's okay, we're still here. We got each other, we're still alive, so that's a blessing.
Wallace Rose Hill High School was closed for 7 weeks. But 3 weeks after the storm, when the grass had begun to dry, the team started playing again.
We started football practice back, trying to get some kind of normalcy. We started practicing, but we practiced in the mornings, and then we'd go work on our houses or, you know, go help others.
Motzinger knew that many of his neighbors were struggling, and so was he.
I got to take care of my 2 sons. My wife needs me to call these people today. I've got to fight this insurance adjuster. I've got to get a quote to get this fixed. Well, they're so busy, they can't give me the quote. These kids need this. Oh, yeah, we got a football game Friday. We got practice today. I've got, you know, 13 hours of film I got to break down. You know, they say God doesn't give you more than you can handle. You know, God's never wrong, but I'm starting to question, you know, he thinks I'm a lot tougher than I really am because I don't know how much I can take.
Coach Motzinger turned the high school's athletic buildings into a distribution center for donated goods to help the entire community.
I'm a fighter. I'm not a whiner. I'm not one to sit there and mope and pout. You roll your sleeves up and you go to work.
But for some of his players, he went even further. Coach Motzinger knew KD and his 2 middle brothers, who are also on the team, were driving almost an hour round trip every day to get to practice.
And I asked him, I said, how much it costs to fill up your gas tank? I think he said $10. $10 is the most he's ever put in his gas tank.
So Coach Motzinger reached into his pocket and pulled out some cash.
And he just hugged me. And he told me he loved me. And I told him I loved him.
When we get on the field, it's straight coach mode. But in school, it's like dad coach.
Despite missing significant practice time, the Bulldogs made it to the playoffs. The team was under a lot of pressure.
Football means so much to our community. And it was the saving grace, you know. I think they felt like we have to win. Our community needs something positive. And I think it just got too much.
The team lost in the 3rd round. The high school locker rooms are back to normal now, except for one corner where giant cans of spaghetti sauce, black beans, and apricot halves are still stacked high. The coach and his family are back in their home. There's still rebuilding to be done throughout the community, and Kevin Motzinger will continue to roll his sleeves up and go to work.
That's Andrea Aswahe. She's a reporter and producer for WBUR's radio series and podcast, Kind World. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.